I'm still lucky.
Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Thursday, March 21st. We have an informational hearing this morning. Mr. Alanak.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a continuation of sorts of the informational meeting from yesterday. Yesterday, you heard about the current status of tobacco taxation in Oregon. Today, we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about potential new taxes and why those taxes may be needed. So on the lineup for today, you have the governor's office is here to talk, to kind of set the stage. And then you have the Oregon Health Authority to go into some detail. And then you have, packing up the back end there is the Legislative Revenue Office, the Department of Revenue, where you're going to hear about what other states do with respect to taxing vaping, for example. And the Department of Revenue will comment on how they would expect to administer such taxes, depending on which direction, if any, the legislature chooses to go this session.
Thank you. So first up, the governor's office, please. And Oregon Health Authority.
Okay, does that work?
Yes.
Okay, great. Good morning. For the record, my name is Tina Edlund. I am the health policy advisor for Governor Kate Brown. I'm happy to be here this morning. I'm here today to speak to the governor's priority for funding the Oregon Health Plan, and an increased tobacco tax is a key part of that priority. Oregon has been an innovator in health policy for decades. We've always shown an increasing, we've always had a goal of increasing level of coverage in the state so that every Oregonian would have access to quality health care no matter who they are or where they live. It's really one of the key priorities in the governor's health care agenda. In Oregon today, under Governor Brown's leadership, we're proud that 94% of all Oregonians have access to health care coverage, 98% of children are covered, 100% have access to health care coverage. We want to sustain those gains. An important part of those gains has been our Medicaid program, which is known as the Oregon Health Plan. It's been a priority for the governor to identify broad-based, long-term funding for the Oregon Health Plan without cutting eligibility or benefits. To that end, the governor pulled together a work group a year ago now. I actually can't believe it's been a year, but in March of 2018, made up of senior executives from the healthcare industry, people who would be impacted by the assessments that we have traditionally talked about in the state. So it was health systems, health plans, representatives of the coordinated care organizations, as well as providers and labor and business were at the table. And Director Allen from the Oregon Health Authority was there as well. We met approximately every 3 weeks between March and October to evaluate revenue options through a consensus-driven process. The group's challenge was to identify $830 million, which was at that time the number we were working with as the gap in Medicaid funding going into this next biennium. So a variety of ideas. There was really nothing that wasn't on the table for the group to consider. A variety of ideas was evaluated and considered during the time, including an expansion of the kinds of providers that we would include in Oregon's approach to provider assessments. In the end, the group recommended to the governor a four-part package made up of proposals that are familiar to us here. The hospital assessment, premium tax, tobacco tax that's included in what the committee will be looking at, and one that's new, which is an assessment against large employers who don't meet a benchmark level of spending for health care for their employees. The hospital assessment and the premium tax have already been passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor. That was House Bill 2010. So I'm here to talk about the third piece of her package, an increase in the tobacco tax. It was included in the package for a couple reasons. The group wasn't just focused on revenue. They were also focused on health. And one of the principles that they operated from was that we weren't going to sacrifice quality or outcomes for revenue. That was off the table from the very beginning in terms of a value statement of the group. They felt that in the long run, the greatest healthcare cost savings come from keeping people healthy. So the tobacco tax proposal put forward by the group is comprehensive for that reason. We understood that the entire range of tobacco and nicotine products cause harm, and we didn't want to merely create incentives to replace one form of tobacco or nicotine product for another. Finally, I want to go back to the governor's direction to the group to find a long-term strategy. The graph that I submitted that I think, if you want to go to the other, yeah, thanks, Pat. The graph that I submitted shows the importance of this revenue source, especially as we look at the next couple of biennia. This the agreement that we came to with the governor's work group on financing Medicaid was a six-year plan. This piece, the tobacco tax piece, was really considered to be a critical element of that six-year plan, and I think this graph shows that. What it shows is the OHP projected funding source by a variety of sources. What I wanted to highlight for you is what happens without those two sources in the next two. The graph actually pairs. If you look at this, there's two bar graphs for each biennia. One shows the fund sources with the tobacco tax and the employer responsibility piece that I talked about. And the other one shows what it is without those two sources of revenue. As you can see, there's no gap in funding going into this next biennia if the entire package the governor proposed is passed by the legislature. Without them, there's a $254 million general fund need that gets filled through general fund sources, depending on, it's really up to the legislature. It's the dollars, though, that could go to education, public safety, or human services that ends up being used here. In 21-23, even assuming that we maintain the 3.4%, we have a goal in the Oregon Health Plan to keep spending at 3.4% per capita, that it grows no more than that. Even if we maintain that 3.4% growth rate in healthcare, and we assume that healthcare gets its proportional share of any growth in general fund, we're still looking at a gap that without this funding source, without these funding sources, would grow to $506 million in 21-23 and $688 million in 23-25. So that really speaks to the importance of this as part of this longer range vision for how to finance the OHP. Finally, the second graph, if you want to pull up that second one, thanks. That second graph really illustrates the associated federal match that you get from the state share in Medicaid. This isn't dependent on, doesn't require that it's tobacco tax as the state funds here. It's just really illustrative of what happens because this is a state-federal partnership. The federal government is actually the majority investor in Medicaid in this state. They pay 60 cents on every dollar that is spent in Medicaid. So with the amount of tobacco tax revenue that we were talking about as part of the governor's package, you can see the associated federal funds that come along with that as when we use that for the Medicaid program. So there's a significant impact.
Excuse me, we have a question for you.
Yes,
Representative
okay.
Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, but I have a question. Can you go to your other chart?
Yeah.
I'm kind of a numbers person, and I don't understand this. When I look at your 1921, I see that in the top, the 120 from subsidized employer assessment and the 95 tobacco tax.
Oh, yeah.
That equals 215, but without those two, you have a shortage of 254. I can't figure that out.
Differences in the insurer tax.
It's the half percent in the insurer tax.
If you look Patrick Allen, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. If you look two more slices down at that kind of an aqua color that is $362 million in 1921 on the left-hand side and $323 million, the insurer tax that just passed raises by a little bit, and that's the added revenue there that should balance that.
Okay,
out.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Should have looked harder. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with that, I'll hand off to Director Allen. I thought if it's suitable for you, Rep. Nathanson, we will take questions at the end.
That's
okay,
fine.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Word is up. All right, thanks again. Patrick Allen, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. My intent is to spend a little bit of time going into a bit more detail about the funding gap and what happens to it over time in the future, and then talk about some other elements of the basically the return on investment of an increase in the tobacco tax. What you see here, the bar graph on the left-hand side represents two biennia, 17, 19, 19, 21, and at the top line you see the increase in the cost of the Oregon Health Plan from about 15, a little bit less than 15 billion to a little bit more than 15 billion, and the stack shows what the different funding components are of that, and that tracks roughly to what Ms. Edlin just talked about in terms of general funds, other funds, provider assessments, and then a large leverage of federal funding. The sliver at the top then breaks out into the pie chart at the right. That's the funding gap that we have today. These numbers are a little bit different than the $830 million number Ms. Edlin referred to, because this is a different point in time than mm-hmm. the work group was working over the summer. But I want to talk about these different slices because they're fairly important. The salmon-colored slice on the right-hand side, $224 million, represents the tendency of healthcare costs, not surprisingly, to go up over time. And there's always going to be an element of that kind of an increase in cost over time. We try very aggressively to manage that in Oregon by capping that growth rate. Over the long run, we have been successful at that. There are years where we're less successful, years where we're more successful. When on the previous graph that showed there being a gap going forward in healthcare financing, that largely is what would tend to drive that gap, is the increase in the basic cost of the program. The green slice on the left are other funds, and that largely represents provider taxes. So the insurer tax, the hospital assessment, those kinds of things that just got adopted by the legislature. Traditionally, we end up showing these as a gap, as we do here, because they have tended to have a two-year sunset. So even though you come into each legislative session with some kind of an expectation that you're probably going to use that funding source, you have to show it at zero and show it so it drives a fairly large portion of the gap, in this case about $250 million. Now that that's been passed with a six-year sunset, that green slice will not typically show up again in the future because it's not going to sunset and you won't have that funding source disappear. The slices on the bottom in blue are a little bit of mix of things that will happen in the future and things that won't. They all represent federal match for the Medicaid program. There's a base federal match that's about 62%, and that federal match rate varies a little tiny bit, 1 or 2 percentage points over time with the strength of the economy and with a fairly significant lag over time. So our federal match rate has been trending down to where it is today at about 62% over the last 3 or 4 years as the economic recovery has continued and as Oregon's performance relative to other states has improved. Those changes, while small, because they cover 600,000 or 700,000 people on the Oregon Health Plan, can have a big financial impact, and they will likely always be there, either plus or minus, depending on where we are in the economic cycle. The other two slices, though, CHIP on the far left part of the blue and ACA or Affordable Care Act on the far right side of the blue, represent the step down over time in the federal match in those programs. They were brought in at 100% match when they were first created and are each stepping down, CHIP to something like, I believe, 75% match, Affordable Care Act down to 90% match. We are near or at the end of those step downs. There will be a little tiny bit of step down left in the next biennium, but largely those big drivers of a gap in the Medicaid funding structure go away because we have tailed out those descending match rates. The point of all of this is to say sometimes it feels like every legislature you come in having to climb a $1 billion mountain to balance the funding in Medicaid, and there have been some big drivers that are a little bit artificial, most of which go away. And so the combination of those drivers going away, the work that we do to manage costs in the system, and the governor's funding package tend to put this on a long-term much, much closer to an equilibrium funding structure.
Mr. Allen, we have a question.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this. I just have two trend questions for you. One is you referred to the cap we put on Medicaid costs, 3.4%, I think. Can you tell us specifically where we have been with that over the last 2 years? And secondly, can you tell us where we are with Medicaid enrollment and whether or not we are starting to see that decline as the economy reportedly gets better?
Certainly. Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. I'll have to get you the last two years. I'll get you the 2 years definitively. The most recent year, we came in at around 5%, so above the 3.4, and we were above that the year before. Over the longer trend, longer time, we've averaged under the 3.4% cap. But I'll get you some detailed, get the committee detailed numbers for that. The enrollment numbers have tended to flatten out at about 1 million enrollees on the Oregon Health Plan. And there's a couple of reasons for that. There are really two big clusters of enrollment in the health plan, the kind of what we think of as the base program and then the Affordable Care Act expansion population. Base program is made up largely of elderly, very sick, disabled, people whose circumstances don't really have anything to do with the economy and are largely going to be driven by population numbers, and that's going to be fairly static. The expansion population started out at about 400, a little bit more than 400,000 people, and has dropped now to about 300,000 people. And today we believe that also is a static population because that is today less dependent on variation in the economy, and it really represents the working poor, people who are employed out there working in low-wage jobs or for employers that have low margins and don't provide, or for whatever reason, don't provide health care. And we think that number also now is fairly sticky. And so I think this million-person enrollment is kind of, we should really look at that as more or less a floor that could increase over time if the economy swings the other direction, but probably won't improve a whole lot more unless there's some significant change in the dynamic of wages or how employers provide health care or something like that. So what I'd like to do now is spend a minute and just talk about other elements of return on investment in an increase in the tobacco tax. Smoking makes people sick and causes them to die, right? That's pretty straightforward, and that's actually all really expensive. 8,000 tobacco-related deaths per year in Oregon, about $1.5 billion spent on tobacco-related health care, $1.4 billion in productivity losses. Those are big numbers that are big economic drivers. Tobacco is still the leading cause of death and disease in the state. And while we've made good progress reducing tobacco and e-cigarette usage, actually tobacco usage, not so much e-cigarette usage, we're still at some fairly significant numbers that you can see here that track more or less with national averages. I want to draw your attention particularly to kids. This looks like a really great outcome, having driven cigarette smoking down from 20% of 11th graders to 8% from 2001 to 2017, and for 8th graders from 12% down to 3%. But if you then add in vaping, you can see that by itself, vaping has out about 6 years worth of those gains in cigarette smoking and set us significantly back in terms of nicotine related products. This is just a quick capture of where we are in terms of a cigarette tax in Oregon. Of course, this is cigarettes only. We don't have a tax on e-cigarettes or vaping, and you can see that we're certainly on the low end of that scale. We're in the neighborhood of states like Kentucky, where they grow tobacco. On the West Coast, we're about $2 below both Washington and California, and somewhat higher than Idaho, since I know that question would likely come up, where they have both a cigarette tax and an income tax, a sales tax on tobacco products. We also know that changes in the price of tobacco have a significant effect on consumption. This is drawn by the CDC from national data looking at price changes in a variety of states over time. I think an Oregon-specific projection is a little bit different than this, but a 10% increase in the price, the overall net price after taxes and everything else, results in about a 4% decrease in consumption by adults and a much larger 7% decrease by youths, and really contributes to the general notion that if you can keep a kid from starting to smoke before they're about 24 or 25, they're unlikely to ever take up the habit. This is just a display of the enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan by county across the state. And this, the pattern, there's not, it looks like there maybe isn't much of a pattern here if, until you factor in sort of the combination of both economic conditions and age. Older counties with an older population are more likely to have more of their health care provided by Medicare rather than private insurance or Medicaid. But the high counties are up nearly 40% of residents are enrollees in the Oregon Health Plan. So just a couple of points about return on investment. About two-thirds of people who are on the Oregon Health Plan want to quit, and over half of them have actively tried in the prior year. And both those rates are actually higher than people who are not on the Oregon Health Plan. It's about 58% who want to quit who are not on on OHP. We calculate that we spend about $375 million a year in health plan benefits related to smoking. And that's a number that as we think about how to hold down to that 3.4% cap, an increase in price that drives down consumption and leads to lower expenditures becomes a tool to help us meet that goal. The last thing I want to mention, we have done some work trying to look at subpopulations within the Oregon Health Plan by race, ethnicity, and we find in general that both the prevalence of smoking, the illnesses caused by it, and the desire and attempts to quit are significantly higher in African-American and Native American enrollees on the Oregon Health Plan than other populations. With that, I'd be happy to stop, and Tina will answer the hard questions, and I'll take the easy ones.
Our agreement was different.
Representative Smith Warner, and then Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for being here. I just have two questions that popped up in listening to that. Number one, did you already say what percentage of health plan members are tobacco users? I see the 67% want to quit,
yeah,
but I wonder if you have it called out in there anywhere.
I have it in my notes. It's higher higher for members on the health plan than the population mm-hmm. generally. I want to say 26%, which is higher than the 17% overall.
Great. Thank you. And then my second question is, do you have an estimate of how many folks on the health plan are dual enrolled, are Medicaid and Medicare?
I do have that number. I don't have it okay. with me. We can report yeah, that back yeah, to the committee. Yeah.
Said that about the static population, yeah. many of them being elderly. I know that's mm-hmm. The dual enrollees who are hard to count because of how the yeah. budgets work together. Mm-hmm. But okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I would appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of part question. I was glad to hear that you said you're not placing one form of tobacco over another one, and revenue is not driving this increase. It's healthcare, and specifically this, the reason for the healthcare component of it is the increased costs would change behavior and people should quit theoretically. Except one form of heating material up and sucking it into your lungs, whether it's hot material, whether it's tobacco or marijuana, is not any different. And we're not talking about going after marijuana. Marijuana that's sold to be smoked is not being touched or affected by this, and I do not understand that. If we want to change behavior and not treat one form of heated inhalant over another, and why aren't we talking about marijuana instead of advocating for parlors so they can smoke marijuana in public? We're not taxing marijuana, we're focusing on tobacco, which you said you're not placing one form above another, but it seems to me you are.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, if memory serves, the tax rate on marijuana is about 45%, so if you're suggesting parity between the two, we'd be happy to have that conversation.
I am. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you? I mean, I believe that you're treating one differently than the other one. I mean, there's several different venues for marijuana. that I'm not talking about. I'm talking about the smoking and the inhalant of marijuana component of it. Why would we treat that any differently than tobacco? And I think it's disparate to do that. And I also believe that, as Representative Smith Warner said, that we're also targeting and focusing on underserved population somewhat by doing this. So I. So. I'll calm down.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for both being here. Could we go back to the slide? I think it's the one with the dual bar graphs that talks about OHP projected state funding over biennium.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's the other presentation, yeah. So. Beautiful. Thank you. So just looking at this here, I see in 2017-19, the funding was about $3.5 billion, and it looks like in 23-25, the funding required is going to be 5.25. I'm just giving you, rough estimates looking at the graph there. Using my limited math skills, that's about an 8.38% increase per year in healthcare. When does this stop? Because if it doesn't, we're doubling every 9 years or 10 years, and I'm concerned that we won't be able to fund our way out of that. So I guess my question is, what are the cost drivers in this? Is it because we continue to add more population to the Oregon Health Plan, or is it a population issue? Or are there other cost drivers there that we need to address? And I know this is the Committee on Revenue, not cost containment, but it just concerns me.
Sure. I wonder if we could go back to your slide on the components, if that's possible, to talk about the drivers of. Yeah. So Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, what this slide shows is what Pat had addressed was the gap is really driven by these three components, and it's the actual growth rate in cost that we permit in the Oregon Health Plan through our agreement with the federal government. That's the 3.4% per capita. So that's some of the growth that you'll see in this system, and it's actually an aggressive number. We work really hard to make changes in policy and the delivery system to try to stay at that 3.4%.
Is that an annual number or is that a biennium number?
It's a biennium number.
Okay, thank you.
And within the agreement that we have with the federal government, it's actually a number that's really evaluated over the length of the agreement, which is 5 years. Okay. The second component of this is the step down in the federal share that we have seen over part of the Affordable Care Act, which actually floors out this next biennium. We won't see any more of that decrease. And then the third piece is what am I missing here?
Part of it is
the expiration on the provider taxes. So I think what you're going to continue to see, we have to think your point is well taken, that we have to work really hard to contain healthcare costs in the state, that if we don't do the work on the ground to change the delivery system, this is going to become a difficult problem for us, and we need to be focused on that. But I do think that part of this is an evening out that we'll see as well.
And if I could just add to that, I won't ask staff to go back to the other graph again, but if you look at the out biennia, that's about a 5% per year increase, given that it's over 2 years. And so that really is the combination at that point of population and ordinary inflation in the program. And managed inflation in the program, and it's in the early biennium that these factors that are ending here begin to tail out of that system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just real quick follow up. So I'm looking at that original graph again, and I I see that it's state allocated. We're not, you're not measuring federal funding in there. So,
yes.
So that would be another part on top of the bar graph if it were complete, the total funding. And that was my concern, that the total funding, how it's growing and the federal funding dipping down makes sense why this would be stepping. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Economics 101 would say that as the price of supply increases, the cost of tobacco increases, the demand for the product will decrease. Mm-hmm. Have you folks, being the Oregon Health Authority, done an analysis based upon potential revenue ideas, what the number of smokers decreasing would be? And can you provide that to us?
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith, I may even have a margin note here at my fingertips that says that, but we did talk about the fact that it's about a 4% decrease in adult smoking, about a 7% decrease in youth smoking for every 10% increase in the net price, 10% in the net price, including taxes. I think...
For every 10% increase, it drops 4%.
4% for adults, 7% for kids. I don't think I have right here the actual whole number that that would be, but we can provide that.
That answers my question right there.
Okay,
thank you.
Great.
Representative Marsh. Thank you, Chair. And building on that, we heard...
I'm sorry for interrupting, but that's from CDC based on national estimates. I think our local modeling from Department of Revenue is somewhat different than that. It would probably be safer for the number for you to rely on, but they're both in the same in the same general neighborhood. Mm-hmm.
But again, just to follow up, a 10% results in 4 to 7%.
Based on national data, Oregon national data may be somewhat different. Sorry for interrupting. Mm-hmm.
And we did hear something from Department of Revenue yesterday, and we can review that again today. Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. So building on that question, we also heard yesterday that the purchase of cigarettes per capita in Oregon is much higher than our adjacent state of Washington, presumably because we have cheaper cigarettes and people come here to buy it. So how do you, when you're looking at the Oregon Health Plan budget, how do you calculate in projections around the drop in purchases within the state?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, we rely on the Department of Revenue to do those forecasts and modeling for mm-hmm. us, and so they would be better positioned to answer okay. that question if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, well, follow up.
Yes, and I am going to ask Mr. Alanak to respond to a couple of these questions okay. in just a minute.
Okay. I would just add that the Department of Revenue really had nothing to be able to tell us in terms of being able to figure out what percentage of those purchases are out-of-state purchases or in-state mm-hmm. purchases. Mm-hmm. We just know there's a big discrepancy. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Representative Reschke.
Thank you.
Could we go to the director, Allen's chart there? Yeah, if you could scroll down a few slides where we see the line graph here going. Perfect. Thank you.
And you want with e-cigarettes or without?
That's probably a better graph because that shows more. So this is Oregon, right? And I'm just wondering what California and Washington look like because we're talking about raising our tax to be on parity or similar to theirs to decrease smoking. So I'd like to see, if possible, if we have data on what California's numbers look like and what Oregon's and what Washington's numbers look like.
Yeah, we'd be happy possible. To report that back
okay.
to the committee.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, and I had one more, but.
Sure.
Thank you. All right. Full of questions this morning. So it says 11th graders and 8th graders. And from my understanding, the law, it's illegal for 11th graders and 8th graders to purchase cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
So raising the tax on something that's already illegal for this age group to purchase, how does that, can you explain how that drives usage down? Because to me, they're getting it through mommy's purse or the black market or something, or they're just swiping it off the shelves, and I don't know if a tax.
Or they have someone legally purchasing it, right. or illegally purchasing it, but for whom the actual purchase is legal. And in any event, at the quantities being smoked, they're ultimately actually paying for the cigarettes. And so I don't think this is casual theft or those kinds of things. And so that price, even if they're not the legal purchaser, will work its way back to them.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Halenak, do you have some additional information?
Well, just to follow up on the question from Rep. Smith about the 10% and the 4%, and the reason you want to consider the national data versus the state is what John was talking about yesterday, were these border effects. Mm-hmm. So you have the actual impact on smoking, but then you have where the cigarettes are purchased. And so one of the things that comes into play there is the relative tax between Washington and Oregon. And so those numbers are a little bit different. There's some disagreement around that 4% per se, but we're still using that as a ballpark in terms of having something in the back of your mind about that overall effect. That's kind of what we go with, but there is this border effect piece that affects the, you kind of have the response in smoking versus the response in tax collections.
Right.
Those are a little bit different.
Thank you.
And if I could add, Chair Nathanson, you also have a response in net pricing by the manufacturers and distributors. How much of the tax do they pass on, and how much of it actually shows up in the net price? And those mm-hmm. figures that I gave were in the final net price, and that may vary depending with the tax as well.
Yeah, the consumer response is to what they pay at the register.
Mr. Halenak, there are a couple of questions that have come up this morning that it might be addressed at least in part or in a general way by Legislative Revenue Office in the next part of the presentation, but since it came up just a few minutes ago, I'm hoping that someone can speak at least in a general way about how we compare from the user's perspective, if someone is using tobacco versus marijuana, how do we compare the amount of tax they're paying when they're using or consuming that particular product, whether it's something being smoked or chewed or swallowed or inhaled with a water pipe? It's so different. How do we, but from the user's perspective, how much are they paying in tax?
I think the other two folks who are talking weren't going to be talking about marijuana tax, so we can look into that.
Good.
Mazen is in the room. If there are questions about the marijuana tax, I don't know if we've done the work really to compare those two on a parity basis. So that might be something we need to get back to you to think a little bit more about how we would compare these products, whether it's price or. I don't know if you would compare THC or CBD to nicotine, some of those questions. So I'm not sure that's an easily answered question, but we can certainly look into it.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one more question on this graph here, if I may. So it looks like with 8th graders and 11th graders, the driver right now is vaping. It's not cigarette smoke or cigarettes, because that seems to be on the decline in both of those. And without, if vaping didn't exist, we'd have a nice graph and be happy. So I'm just wondering, if we just placed a tax on vaping, can we get back to the numbers from a health perspective that we can live with? I know that may not drive the revenue that's desired or required, but I'm just wondering from a health perspective, if just adding a tax on vaping, or would they switch back to cigarettes, or do we not know?
I will check to see if that's something that we know, but okay. At this point, I would say we don't know that.
Yeah.
But
okay,
if we have data on that, I'll report back.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you go to page 3 of your presentation, please? Is there that shows, you know, the costs and medical consequences of using tobacco and the other products in cigarettes or e-cigarettes? Do we have data of what marijuana causes in terms of health consequences and medical care related expenses and death rates? Because I think that will be helpful to understand that these are two very different things.
Sure. Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez. We'll provide the committee what data we have. I will observe that generally data like that in marijuana is much thinner because legalization is fairly recent, and previously there have been significant federal prohibitions on research and those kinds of things. But to the extent that we have data like that, I'm happy to share it.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was saying to Representative Reschke as well that in all of the conversations I've had with whether it's OHA or health advocates, the dual purpose of tobacco and vaping taxes, it is truly, they would be thrilled if it raised no money because it drove so many people to quit smoking. That it's, you really can't disengage the combined. The goal is always, I would argue, more the health impact than it is the revenue. Yes, it is a way to fill the gap, and at the same time, ultimately, your revenue projections don't meet because you drive so many people out of smoking, but then you're saving money on the other end in the plan. And I would argue on the children front particularly, that they are so much more price sensitive than adults are. And if you can stop them at, you know, from accessing the vaping, making it more expensive. Speaking as somebody who, I was a smoker for 20 years, I illegally bought cigarettes for a number of years before I was 18 through a variety of mechanisms.
Statute of limitations, right?
Right, statute, yeah. That's what I'm thinking. And interstate commerce, because it wasn't here, so. But that, I remember that. I mean, you would smoke when you could get the money, and the more money you had to get in order to make that happen, the less you were gonna smoke. I mean, it really is such a more direct connection. So I just wanted to comment on that in regards to Representative Reschke's comment.
And Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, if I could just pile on to that. We were working on this as an agency concept before the work group was even convened around Medicaid funding for that very reason, that it's good public health policy.
Any other questions for this panel?
I can't be the only
one.
Thank you for your
name
this morning.
Next, we will hear from the Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue Office.
Smoked cigarettes for 25 years. I smoked cigars for 10.
Nice. Do you still smoke cigars?
No.
Would you pass that to me? Right.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about potential administration of a tax increase for cigarette tax and then inclusion of vape tax and the other tobacco products if you were to pass such a bill. At the time that a cigarette tax increase is passed, we generally have in the statute what's called a floor tax, and that means that all cigarette distributors, wholesalers, and retailers must take an inventory of the stamped cigarettes that are in their possession, basically on their floor, and the distributors must also count the stamps that they have in their possession that are not yet affixed to cigarettes. So we call that, these folks have to count their affixed and unaffixed stamps. So these distributors, wholesalers, and retailers then file a one-time tax return, special one-time tax return, that's typically due about 20 days after the date of the effective date of whatever the tax increase is. Usually that's been January 1st of a year, so it's somewhere around the 20th of January that the tax return is due. It can be any date, actually, based on what you put in the statute. The floor tax is one time. So there has been some confusion about that. It is just to reflect the difference between the old tax rate and the new tax rate. The floor tax eliminates the need for us to create a new stamp for the difference between the old rate and the new rate, and for retailers to affix the stamp to the packs of cigarettes. If you think about postage stamps, you know, the mail, you have to have a current rate on there, and so you have to put the difference on. This floor tax eliminates that process. It eliminates the needs for retailers to have to return the product with old stamps to the distributors and have them then put the additional stamp on there. It saves retailers, distributors, and the state time and money by simply paying the tax on the difference between the old value of the stamp and the new value of the stamp. So imposing a floor tax also discourages stockpiling of the tax stamps at the old rate. So generally, we have floor tax returns available for distributors and retailers by the end of the month preceding when the return is due. So if it were due in January, we'd have it available by the end of December. And the retailers, these folks can file on our revenue online website. That would be available for them. The most recent cigarette floor tax was part of the 2013 special session, House Bill 3601, and it had a 13-cent increase in it and two future 1-cent increases, the most recent and the last of which went into effect January 1 of 2018. So if a cigarette tax increase were to occur, we would reach out and educate about 3,800 to 4,000 retail locations, retailers, and about 175 licensed wholesalers through the mail. We would send at least two separate letters to help them and help inform them of their new obligation. We would send them an early notification letter, you know, about the upcoming rate change and their inventory, their return, and their payment obligations. And then shortly before the obligation, we would send a reminder about the inventory return and remittance process. This letter would actually include instructions on how to actually file online. Through licensed distributor accounts, the department would also send communications to cigarette distributors regarding the rate change and floor tax via email, because there's only 40 of them. The lack of registration and licensing requirement for cigarette retailers, however, or any requirement for licensed cigarette distributors to share their retail clients with us, does present some challenges in our ability to identify subject retailers and compromises somewhat our enforcement efforts. But we are every time we have a floor tax, we do learn from our enforcement efforts, so that helps guide us in the implementation of another one. The last one prior to this 2014 one had been in 2002. The amount of the floor tax compared to the current tax rate has a direct impact on compliance. So the higher the change, the lower the tax compliance. And distributors, wholesalers, and retailers must pay the floor tax up front before sales of product occur, where they can recoup the amount of tax when the product is sold. At least one state has passed a floor tax allows retailers to pay the floor tax in installments. In Oregon, taxpayers are allowed to do payment plans for delinquencies, but we don't have a law that would allow like a short-term payment plan with no penalty or interest for the late payments. However, you could choose to do something like that if you wanted. Currently, if a taxpayer can't pay the floor tax by the due date, so 20 days after the effective date of the tax, a 5% failure to pay penalty and normal interest charges apply. For the inhalant delivery system taxation, that's the vape tax, there are several bills this session that would impose a tax on these inhalant delivery systems or similar products, also known as, you know, e-cigarettes and vapor products. Like I said yesterday, cigarettes are the shredded tobacco leaves that's wrapped in paper, usually with a cotton filter at the end of it. You burn it, you inhale it, that it's drawn into your lungs. The vapor products are a little bit more complex. They don't actually burn like that. They actually have the device has a battery, and I think I might be stealing some of Kyle's thunder because he has a great picture of what they look like in his presentation. The vapor products have a battery, generally a cartridge that contains varying levels of nicotine in it that could be flavored. It contains an atomizer, usually a heating coil, an LED light that turns on when the device is in use, and sometimes even looks like a flame at the tip of the device, and a sensor which detects when a person is inhaling and activates the atomizer and LED light. Once the sensor is triggered, the atomizer heats the fluid and converts it to vapor, which is then inhaled. So the big difference here is that one is actually combustible and the other is not. But sometimes they look similar, but they're very aesthetic in nature. It's not actually. Nine states and the District of Columbia impose an excise tax on inhalant delivery or vapor products. Some states tax them as part of the state's other tobacco products tax. Some states tax them based on measurements, so ad valorem. Thanks, Kyle. In other words, they base the tax on the amount of nicotine in the liquid or simply the volume of the liquid. There's a list online and also in Kyle's material, that provides the way the other states are taxing it. California, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and the District of Columbia tax these products in their other tobacco products, and six other states tax it based on measurement. including the inhalant delivery systems in the other tobacco products tax would allow DOR to include these new categories in an existing tax program, which minimizes our implementation costs for DOR, and it minimizes the additional administrative burden on taxpayers that are currently reporting the tobacco taxes. The savings is largely because taxing it based on measurement or the volume of nicotine in the liquids or the quote-unquote juice would likely require lab testing of the content to ensure the product is taxed and labeled correctly. If a tax on inhalant delivery systems were enacted as part of the existing OTP program, as many of the bills that I've seen are contemplated in this, we would be able to implement it in very short order because it's simply adding another product to the tax, a well-established tax program. If you were to choose to do an entirely new tax program based on volume like other states have done, we would likely need 12 months from the effective date for us to be able to get it in place and administer it. But because most of the bills are talking about OTP, adding it in OTP, that's what I'll go over, a high-level implementation plan. So if you were to include it in the other tobacco tax programs, we would perform outreach to, again, approximately almost 4,000 retailers and 175 wholesalers by mail. Same kind of thing as we would do with a cigarette tax increase. We would explain the requirements to register as a tobacco distributor and acquire taxed product from a licensed tobacco distributor. We would have to reach out to about 160 licensed other tobacco products distributors, notifying them of the addition of the new product into the other tobacco tax return and the new requirements. This is a little bit different because we estimate there are probably about 150 or so vape-only retailers who are currently not licensed as tobacco distributors. And these retailers would need to get licensed as a tobacco distributor to continue with their current business model of bringing untaxed vapor products into Oregon. These distributors then, after they become a distributor, they would then be responsible for the tax on the wholesale sales price of the product they bring in. Unlike existing retailers that sell cigarettes and other tobacco products, these businesses would need additional education and on the requirement to acquire only taxed products because they haven't been subject to any of these taxes before or been required to obtain a license or just simply the new requirement of reporting and remitting this tax. So we take a balanced approach to tax administration through education, assistance, and enforcement. And we tend to make heavy outreach efforts when there's a new tax in place. And so we would plan to do quite a bit of education and assistance to help these folks with their new filing and payment obligations. So that's kind of a high-level implementation plan for what we would do if these were to pass.
Thank you. Let's hear from LRO now.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Eason, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, I do have materials up online. And they touch on a lot of the same things that Department of Revenue, Deanna, just touched as well. So I'll just try to fill in a couple additional areas that I had information on.
This is a new topic area for us. So feel free to start at the first slide if you want.
Okay. So again, yeah, I was just starting off with the first couple slides are information that the committee received yesterday. And this is just about the existing tax structure we have for cigarettes and OTP. The collections and those sorts of things. I don't plan to really talk about them because the committee heard about them yesterday, but I put them up there just in case we needed to reference them in this discussion. But as Deanna described, the vapor products, so Oregon has Oregon statute, inhalant delivery systems is our kind of definition for these vapor products. You hear e-cigarettes, but e-cigarettes are really just a subset of the whole market of the inhalant delivery systems or the vapor products. And I tend to use vapor products just because it's easier to say than inhalant delivery systems. But vapor products, there are different products. And this is kind of key when you're thinking about if the legislature were to impose a tax on this, keeping that in mind, because how you levy a tax could be influenced by the type of product that's out there. So what you have on the screen in front of you right now is the vapor products. You can see there's things like the e-cigarettes. And these can be a disposable e-cigarette, so you use it and then you throw it away, or there's ones where you might refill them or insert a new cartridge related to the nicotine juice, the vapor juice, so to speak. And there's also things that are vape pens, these larger products that are maybe called vapor tanks, and that's what you see in the lower left. The ones here where you would fill them with the vapor juice. And again, they're kind of a different product as they're reusable. So you buy the device and then you refill it with a different vapor juice, different flavors, different nicotine content, and so forth. There's some ability of the consumer to decide how to do that. And then the bottom right is that's kind of a vape stick, I guess, is the example there. So again, yes, it is the Juul vape stick, which is a big control or is a big part of the market. So that's why I use that one.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any discussion around taxing that, the actual stick or product, as opposed to the inhalant itself, or are we looking at a tax that does both?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Reschke, that does depend upon the tax that would be imposed, absolutely. And as Deanna mentioned, there's really almost two categories you can think of how to tax. You can do specific to the vapor juice, so most other states are doing per milliliter of the vapor juice, and then, or you could take more of the other tobacco products or bring it within like our OTP existing structure where you're taxing maybe the wholesale value or a retail value. And in that case, you'd be looking at the whole device. In many cases, it can be structured differently, but that is a key determinant is, do you want to just focus the tax on the nicotine juice itself, so to speak, or do you want to get the device, the battery, the charger, all that comes with it? And that's one of the key things in the product itself is, again, there are those disposable products that are kind of an all-in-one, they're purchased all-in-one, and there's others where you purchase the device and then maybe the liquid separate or refillables for the liquid. So that's a key thing to keep in mind.
Follow up, thank you, Madam Chair. So what does one of those devices, let's just pick the upper left one, do you know what the retail price of something like that is? I mean, what are we talking? Are we talking $10? Are we talking $60? What's it take to get into this market if I wanted to begin vaping instead of smoking? And you may not know that answer.
It's been a while since I looked at the numbers. Deanna's whispering that she has a...
Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, I've seen these items for sale, like the Juul product. I've seen starter kits about $40 to $50 with some cartridges in it, depending on, and that's about the starting point. Some of these small ones, like in the upper right-hand corner, are a little bit less expensive, the blue and the different products. The bigger products with the tanks and the giant batteries at the bottom right-hand corner, those can be upwards of $100. And then and anything in between, depending on how big or how much storage or liquid goes into them.
And so I guess my comment to the committee would be that we heard that 8th and 11th graders are switching from cigarettes to vaping products, but they're finding the money to purchase for $50 or $100 to get started in this market, because apparently it's cheaper than to continue on with the refillables. All the components seem to be left. If cost is the driver, I've got to think that the barrier to get into vaping is not enough, because the long-term continuing of vaping is a lot less than a cigarette is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So just a brief overview of the vapor market. This is information that comes from Wells Fargo, just to give you a sense of the size of the overall market. And one thing just to keep in mind is this is still a fairly new product. So these numbers change quite a bit year over year. They can change by sizable amounts. It can increase by $1 billion in just 1 year pretty simply. So there's a lot of, it's a fluid market. In the lower right corner, there's a pie chart there. And I think that's maybe the takeaway on this slide, really, because the numbers themselves are moving so much with the market growth. But right now we're looking at about 75% of the market are these rechargeable refills. So it's not these individual purchase disposable devices, but it is really the refill devices that are the leading or the largest component of the market, right now at least. So one thing that I don't think Deanna hit on, so actually a new piece here, is the government oversight and how that can influence the market. So that's a really big outlier piece piece that's out there right now, and that's how the FDA that has oversight responsibility now for this market, how they're going to interact with it. And even just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen new proposed rules coming out from the FDA and how they will treat these devices. Again, this is another area where there's a lot of movement here. Initial deadlines have been moved, so there is, we'll see how things are going to fall out here, but just in many senses, flavors is the most recent discussion topic, how they'll treat the flavors of these nicotine juices and such. So again, the key takeaway there is just the federal oversight could heavily influence the size of the market going forward, certainly. In terms of tax policies, again, reiterating what Deanna said, there really are primarily two ways in which taxes have been levied on this. The first is the specific tax, so that's pointed to the per milliliter or, of the liquid. It comes up into a comment you made or a question you had earlier, Madam Chair, related to the nicotine content to try to get at like the quote harm from these devices. And even on the OTP or the tobacco products, that's a difficult thing to do. Just even in the measurements of consuming a cigarette, how you smoke the cigarette changes how and what it is that you're inhaling. So going to the harm that sometimes gets discussed, especially with the products, because you can have different amounts of nicotine in the liquid, it's a difficult thing to do. Again, as Deanna said, you would need like a lab to test these things. Why it might be advertised to confirm that for tax purposes, that's a significant hurdle certainly to get to, and none of the other states have looked at that yet. The specific tax, in some way, that's similar to Oregon's OTP. Again, when you think about focusing on the product, that's similar to taxing like the pipe tobacco, but not the pipe. Mm-hmm. And again, it picks up on how these, there are certainly devices and the prices of the devices compared to the refillable liquid. And then the second way forward that other states have done is that ad valorem. So that's maybe it's retail price, wholesale price, something along those lines. And again, as discussed earlier, that captures the whole price of the product generally. And then lastly, this is a list of the other states and how what they've done. We have had some movement in this as well. We've seen different prices, different amounts put on the liquid. So it's still pretty early for a lot of these states, but we are starting to get some information from these other states, what their collections have been. So that's helpful in our case in trying to put together a model of what Oregon would see if Oregon were to enact a tax similar to one of these other states. We're at least a few years ago, it was all still kind of hypothetical how this would look. But now we are starting to see some receipts from other states, which can be helpful in providing information to you all.
Representative Roeschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, I see California on the list. I don't see Washington. Do we know if Washington's looking at this at all or not? Or maybe Deanna knows that.
Madam Chair and Representative Roeschke, I was looking at a list last night, actually, of other states. I think that Washington was on the list of states that have considered it but not passed it. There's a number of states on that list that are struggling with it the same way we are, trying to figure out how to tax it.
Yeah, because I guess my comment is that if we tax this and Washington doesn't, then we're just going to drive traffic across the border, and we haven't really solved anything if we're after the health aspect of this. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any idea the revenue from the different models? I mean, from the ad valorem to the specifics, do we have any idea what that number would be?
Representative Finley, we have done estimates in the past. I don't have anything with me in the presentation right now, but that is something we can get back to you on. And again, this is one area I know typically we don't like to give range estimates. But it is one of those with keeping in mind the FDA rules and everything of different scenarios possibly going forward. But yeah, we can definitely get information to you. Sure.
I'm looking at a National Conference of State Legislatures website right now, a report that they publish on alternative nicotine products. And on that page is a list of all the statutes in every state relating to either prohibition or taxation and so forth. So I'm hoping that LRO can send the link for this page to the committee.
Great.
Representative Marsh.
I would just add, similar to Rep. Roeschke's concerns, that as far as I know, we have no limitations on mail order of vaping products. So to the extent that we impose a tax on that, not that that, just something to factor in.
All right.
because we do have, we heard yesterday, there's retail or direct consumer delivery of cigarettes is verboten,
right,
but not for e-cigarettes or refillables on these products. So yeah.
And the tobacco sniffing dogs wouldn't be able to find this in a package.
That should be a little difficult. Yes.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you, too, also for being with us today. Thank you, everyone, for your presentations. There's no other business. We're adjourned.